Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Liz Tregenza about her book titled Wholesale Couture, London and Beyond, 1930 to 1970, published by Bloomsbury in 2023, which is a really interesting book because in a lot of ways it fills a gap in our understanding of kind of how London became such a part of the fashion industry, how ready-to-wear became such a thing in London, how Paris, how fancy posh French couture made its way to other places, what was happening during the kind of World War II, post-World War II era in terms of fashion. Who's involved in this? What are they doing? I mean, there's really a lot to talk about here. So Liz, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you and wonder if you could please start by introducing yourself to our audience a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book.
Of course. So yeah, I'm Dr. Liz Tregenza, and I am currently a lecturer in cultural and historical studies at London College of Fashion. Aside from this, I'm also a vintage dealer. And really, actually, it's this kind of background as a vintage dealer, someone who's always collected vintage and historical clothes, that led me to wholesale couture. So I probably started collecting vintage when I was about 15. And since then, I've collected from all sorts of different places. You know, I've bought American vintage, I've bought European vintage. But as someone who grew up in London, a lot of what I was buying was actually British made vintage clothes. And in doing so, I became really interested in certain labels that I'd find time and time again. And this is really what led me to wholesale couture. So there were certain brands, as I say, that I'd find these brands and I became increasingly interested in them. And I started to research these labels. And after a while, I found out about, you know, the sector of the market called wholesale couture. And I was just fascinated with it because it sounded like such an unusual term. I wasn't really sure what wholesale couture meant. But there was all of these firms describing themselves as such. And this is kind of really where my research came from. I started with the objects and then went from there into a deep dive into trying to understand about these companies that formed part of this sector of the market, what they were making, how they were positioning themselves, and how they were part as well of like a global fashion industry. This is something I've always been really interested in. You know, we can look up these specifics about things to do with London or Britain, but actually fashion is always part of this global network, whether that's from matters of production, marketing, selling. Always really interested me.
I mean, having read the book and seeing what you were able to figure out and put together, I can see why. So thank you for that introduction. But before we go any further, I think it's worth clarifying kind of what this thing is that you found so interesting and that I've been able to read the book and gone, ooh, wait, no, that is quite intriguing. So what do we mean when we say wholesale couture? And does our understanding of that term now, is that what it would have meant during the period of 1930 to 70?
Well, wholesale couture is, I'm really interested in it as a term, is it doesn't actually quite make sense, and it didn't really quite make sense at the time either. So wholesale couture is a term that kind of, it describes the very top end of the London ready-to-wear clothing industry. So companies who were part of this sector were producing clothes that were often based or adapted from Parisian or Italian haute couture designs, but they were made up in Britain using ready-to-wear techniques. And the ready-to-wear techniques that these products were made using were actually also inspired by the American industry. And wholesale couture traded on this kind of what I term like an oxymoronic exclusivity. So these pieces, they weren't one-offs by any stretch, but they were made to sort of, they had this veneer of luxury associated with them through the way that they were marketed, through the way that they were made. But certainly, you know, wholesale couture as an industry, it only really existed. So my book is titled 1930 to 1970, but the actual first usage of the term wholesale couture that I found dates to 1935. And the reason why I chose to use this term over any of the others that were sort of bandied around at the time was because this to me sort of connoted the sense of exclusivity but ready-madeness of these clothes that was so sort of interesting to me. But, you know, these firms also referred to themselves in other different ways as well. Sometimes they were called model houses. Sometimes they were just called ready-to-wear manufacturers as well. And wholesale couture as a term, I think, is interesting because it builds off what's happening in other countries in Europe. But it's very, very much, it's a different use of terminology to what you have in Europe, even if you think about translations. And I think this is about the fact that these firms were really keen to set themselves apart from other ready-to-wear manufacturers in Europe to really sort of stake their position internationally.
Terminology is particularly interesting in this case, so thank you for taking us through that. If we're thinking then of kind of who these people are, where these firms are, what they're like, can you situate us within London? Where are we in London? When are we in London? Kind of how does all of this develop? And to what extent is the Londonness of it an important piece?
Yeah, I love thinking about the Londonness of this. I'm really interested, you know, like I always think it's interesting to think about how people personally get involved and interested with their research topic. So, you know, like I grew up on the outskirts of London. And London as a city and its sort of multifarious identities has always fascinated me. And looking at something like the wholesale couture sector, when thinking about how different parts of London have all of these different identities, is really interesting to me. So wholesale couture is what they have is they have their sites of manufacturing. So they have their factories, but they also have their showrooms. Now I'm going to talk first about their showrooms. So almost all of the wholesale couturiers are based in London, in London's Mayfair. So they're based in the same streets as actually the couturiers are. And this is really intentional. It's about sort of setting up their positioning within the fashion industry at large. So Frederick Stark, who I'm sure I might speak about a bit today. So Frederick Stark is I have jokingly referred to him as my second boyfriend. But he is who I actually wrote my PhD on. And Frederick Stark was based on Bruton Street for most of the time he was operating. And Bruton Street is a road which also had a number of London couturiers were also based on the same road. So lots of the wholesale couturiers, they had their showrooms in Mayfair. And what this meant was this was where wholesale couturiers would have the press coming to visit them. It's also where, for example, buyers from department stores and independent dress shops would come. But wholesale couturiers, and this is something, a distinction I'd really like to make, is they weren't making clothes for individual clients. So these showrooms were not spaces where individual clients were coming. It was sort of mostly buyers and press who would have been visiting these spaces. But they had an important, what I would consider like a symbolic capital within these spaces, because it was often within the showrooms that things like their advertising were shot. And Frederick Stark's, his showroom was really distinctive. And it had these luxury thick Persian carpets, and it had this amazing scrolling iron, or I imagine cast iron screen, which was all used in the backdrop of his advertising. And I bring this specific point up about his showroom because in the current exhibition, which is on at the Museum of London Docklands, Fashion City, How Jewish Londoners Shaped Global Style, the screen from Frederick Stark's showroom has actually been recreated in the exhibition, which is really lovely. And I felt quite over emotional to see it there. So yes, most of these firms, they have their showrooms in Mayfair. However, most of their products are not actually being made in the showroom within the same sites as the showrooms. And this is because rents are very expensive in this part of London. So it's just not feasible for them to also make their products here. And what you tend to find is that most are making their products in the East End of London, particularly a typical home of the rag trade more broadly. There's also some who are manufacturing in Tottenham, certainly, and a few others further afield. But the Londonness of wholesale couture is really important. And throughout this period, 1930 to 1970, the majority are making their clothes in London. You know, the Londonness of their brands is very obvious through what they're doing, through the making of the products and also through their advertising. So I know I said, you know, lots of their advertising is shot in their showrooms, but you do also find advertising which is shot in kind of like iconic locations in London. So one of my favourite advertisements is one for a brand called Coopy. And it's shot outside of the British Museum. And it's against one of the sort of statues outside of the British Museum, and it's the way that the model sort of just reclines against it, and these sort of, I suppose it's interesting to consider how something like wholesale couture, it sort of markets itself on these traditions of London, and that's really important in thinking, I suppose, about how these products are being sold as a British product, not only at home in Britain but also overseas as well.
Thank you for taking us through those different locations. And I'm glad you added those details about the rugs and the screens. Like, it really helps us visualize what this looked like. And this, to me, the interesting in-between placement of all of this. Like, It's posh, but it's posh in specific ways, right? And not exactly in the ways that other things are. So all the sorts of details are helpful for placing them. You mentioned earlier the idea of drawing from American practice in the manufacturing processes particularly. Could you tell us a bit more about what these firms in London are drawing from the US?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting what they do. And I think it's important to note here that America was really advanced in the early 20th century in terms of how it was manufacturing ready-to-wear clothing. And I'm situating this particularly around New York because it's where I know the manufacturers I've researched were going. But this isn't to say it was only New York they were taking inspiration from. And what was happening was that this started in the very late 1920s, actually. Firms who would later become part of the wholesale couture trade more broadly, they were traveling over to America and they were looking at the machinery. They were taking inspiration from how the machinery was manufactured, and sometimes even importing machinery from the US to the UK to produce their goods on. They were also looking at the systems through which products were made. So they were thinking about how efficient American manufacture was and trying to replicate this in the UK. Even more so, they were bringing people over from the US in order to work in these factories. So I know there's quite a number of factory managers who I've researched were American. And I say this with a note of caution, because when I say they're American, a lot of these people were actually originally born in Europe of Jewish heritage, who'd moved to America when they were very young, and then ended up coming to Britain when they were in their sort of 40s, 50s to continue to work in the wholesale couture trade. So there's a really interesting sort of multi-layered immigration that happens. There's also a couple, actually, quite interestingly, of designers who come over from the US and work in the London wholesale couture firms. There's one in particular whose name, he actually changed his name. So I'll use the name he changed it to, which was Wallace Wallace. So good, they named him twice. So that was his actual chosen name. But he'd had a really successful career in the US, and in I'm doing this off the top of my head here, so I hope I'm remembering the right date. I think it was about 1933. He came over to the UK and he actually established sort of a subsidiary firm within one of the wholesale couture companies. So he established a company called Spectator Sports, which was a subsidiary of a company called Rose and Blairman, and he was really successful. And he was quite interesting because he was a designer coming over, but he was bringing over like ideas about things sort of around how American showrooms were being designed as well. So it was like his aesthetic as well as manufacturing techniques. And I think, you know, that London wholesale couture trade is something which is really unique to London. However, when saying that, it's something which draws on all of these different international influences, which I think is so interesting in terms of thinking about how do you create something that's uniquely British, and you're doing it by actually borrowing from so many different countries.
Yeah, no, it really makes that point that kind of this whole thing is very interconnected, and it's not just from one place or entirely from one place or another. I wanted to ask about a specific year. I know that's always tricky when writing a book that covers such a time period, but 1946, really, there's a lot going on in this year for the wholesale couture industry. So can you take us to 1946? What is going on? Why is this such a key year?
So I am quite obsessed with 1946. And I always say if I could time travel, I would go to 1946 and I would like to spend my time. I think I'd actually I'd pick a couple of months. So I'd go between, I'd say about June and October. I'd like to go back to 1946. So 1946 is this year of real change that happens in the fashion industry. And one of the reasons why I've become so obsessed with 1946 is because it's a year that I think when most historians look at the 1940s as a decade, they ignore it. You know, what happens is you go, well, there's World War II, that ends, and then Christian Dior arrives. And that's how these narratives of fashion are told again and again and again. But if you think of that, well, the war ends in 45. Christian Dior's first collection isn't until 1947. So where does 1946 sit in this? It gets forgotten and ignored. And I think I love the underdog, and I feel like 1946 is like an underdog of a year. And I think it deserves this kind of reconsideration. And I think about this from many different perspectives, because 1946 is a year in which the fashion industry, particularly in Britain, is going, well, what can we do? How can the fashion industry be a key part of Britain's sort of return to success, reinvigoration post-World War II? And how can the fashion industry in Britain set itself apart from its other European rivals? And I think this is really important in the context of considering that, you know, Paris is still in a sort of trying to recover, and London is in this sort of period of recovery too. But in 1946, there's a number of kind of intertwined events that happen. And as I argue in the book, I think wholesale couturiers are at the real forefront of this, because what they're trying to think is they're going, well, what can we do to try and establish London's position as a fashion centre or a fashion city? And they're thinking about this in an interesting context as well, because wholesale couturiers had historically, pre this date, they'd been copying Paris. So with the absence of, you know, Paris in its attempts to recover, well, how are they going to establish their position? And wholesale couturiers, there's a few things that happen in this year, 1946, which are sort of vital to this recovery, and they're vital to sort of London's positioning as a fashion centre. So I would say there's, and this is what I talk about in one chapter of the book, there's these three events that all occur within the autumn of 1946 that are vital to this post-war recovery. So we start off with something called the Model House Group's first show. And this is on the 11th of September, 1946. And this group, the London Model House Group, they are a group of wholesale couturiers. primarily headed up by Frederick Stark, but also the group also has a number of other key members. So there's Alec Brenner, who's part of Brenner Sports, and there's Charles Cooperstein, who is behind Coopy. And Charles Cooperstein was likely the person who inspired the foundation of the Model House Group. I'm saying this off of, you know, reading between the lines of various sources, but I think this comes off his experience of traveling to the US and perhaps drawing his inspiration from those trips to the US, the formation of this group. So the Model House Group is formed to kind of organize the wholesale couture sector together, sort of present itself as a united front to the rest of the fashion industry, but actually the general public as well. And I think it's clear that this does have an impact beyond, its formation does have an impact beyond just the fashion industry, because what it does is you see the Model House Group popping up as a collective organisation in, you know, your daily newspapers and things like that, and in your fashion magazines. You know, this group have formed together in 1946, and this is really significant. You also have two other big events that happen. There is something called Britain Can Make It, which is an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum, which also opens in the autumn of 1946. And one of the largest elements of Britain Can Make It is its display of fashion. And the reason why I try and sort of situate the importance of the Model House Group is because, so Britain Can Make It has fashions displayed that were created by the London couturiers, by wholesale couturiers, and also by what we might term like popular price, sort of lower price ready-to-wear designers and companies as well. And almost all of the wholesale couture that is displayed within Britain Can Make It was made by members of the Model House Group. So this, I would argue, helps to position why the Model House Group was so kind of central and important to the trade. And you really notice there's not a great number of images that survive of Britain Can Make It and of the clothes that are shown, but you get the impression from seeing this of how the, you know, the organisation behind Britain Can Make It, how they're trying to put forward an image of what they want the fashion industry to look like in the post-war period. And it's very sort of sooty, tweed heavy, I would say, which is quite interesting. The other event that happens in the autumn of 1946 is something called the Guild of Creative Designers Midnight Ball of Fashion. Now, the Guild of Creative Designers are actually another group of wholesale couturiers, and I only talk about this group a little bit in the book. I'm primarily focused on the Model House Group. This is because I would argue that the Guild of Creative Designers is perhaps a little bit less successful. But the reason why I was interested in them and this midnight ball of fashion that they put on is because it speaks of the sort of differences there are in the industry. There was a lot of actually criticism of the clothes produced for this midnight ball of fashion, because in the post-war period they were considered as overly extravagant and perhaps not appropriate for promoting the sort of vision of London fashion. And also there was something of these clothes that the Guild of Creative Designers were producing that had these very clear kind of Parisian influences. And I think, you know, there were arguments in this immediate post-war period of being like, well, how does London set itself up as something different? How does London establish its own identity? And I think the Model House Group and the wholesale couturiers who were part of it, they were more successful in doing this, certainly. But 1946, I think it's just, I'm really interested in it as a year beyond just thinking about fashion, just because I think it does, it is a, you know, that in very immediate post-war period, it gets a bit forgotten about when we're so concentrated on kind of World War II and how that sort of defines the 1940s.
Well, thank you for introducing us to the underdog story. I think always quite good fun. And in fact, I'd love to pick up on something you mentioned sort of towards the end of that, the idea of London setting itself apart. We can't be too French. We can't be too Parisian. But of course, that was, and in many ways still is, kind of one of the centers of world fashion, sort of the most cutting edge. So how did the wholesale couture industry in London kind of, you don't want to ignore Paris, you can't ignore Paris, but how do you take the avant-garde that's coming out of Paris and turn it into something that doesn't just set London apart, but that sort of middle-class women in Britain are willing to wear, want to wear? I mean, we all see, for example, today that somewhat crazy things going down the runway. You wouldn't necessarily buy them yourselves if you're a middle-class woman in Britain. You know, how does wholesale couture help us, help consumers, help fashion make that transition?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how it does. It's this, and I refer to it in the book as like this kind of re-engineering of Paris fashion. What's quite interesting is, and there are actually very few opportunities to do this proper side by side because of what survives. But when you look at a wholesale couture piece and a Parisian couture piece side by side, you know, from photographic evidence, you might actually struggle to really identify the difference. It would almost be a bit like playing a very detailed game of spot the difference. But these clothes that were being produced by wholesale couturiers were often really, in many ways, taking their inspiration extremely heavily from Parisian couture. They were, in many instances, copying. I will say they were copying legally. They were buying toiles or patterns to copy. But the way that they were re-engineering them for the lives of middle-class women, it's really, in many ways, this is about cost. So they're ensuring that they're within what middle-class women can afford. It's also often about sort of just gently simplifying things. So it's thinking about the fabric that is used, the care properties of how you might be looking after these garments so that they're, you know, easier to wear, easier to clean. It's also, you know, there's one key element here, which is wholesale couture pieces. They're made in a set of circumscribed sizes. What's generally, most wholesale couturiers are producing their clothes in a size 10 to 18, which in modern day sizes is about a 6 to 14. Some did offer a larger size range than that, but this is how they're sort of being re-engineered. You'll notice it in things like the very gentle elements of how things are finished. Although I will say that much wholesale couture clothing is still beautifully made, and that's one of the privileges of researching in the way I do, you know, a real material culture focus, is the opportunity to look inside these garments and really understand, not just look, you know, the broader companies themselves, but thinking about, well, how are people physically going about making these clothes? And, you know, it's really a testament to how much wholesale couture was made that it can still be worn 60, 70 years after it was made. So I think the re-engineering is actually it's mostly a case of gentle simplifications and also bringing things in line with the prices that middle class women could afford. And one other thing I do want to mention here, and I think this is particularly important and significant to consider, is that these clothes weren't cheap. Wholesale couture clothes were still quite expensive, but this has, if we see this from the lens that actually people did generally spend a lot more on their clothing in the 40s, 50s, even into the 1960s. So, you know, if we're looking at turning this to contemporary figures, you're talking the modern equivalent of at least probably £150 at the very minimum for a day dress, for example, from a wholesale couture firm, maybe even a little bit more. That's the kind of price point that they were looking at.
No, that's helpful to understand. So thank you for adding that in. Can you talk, I suppose we've just spoken a bit about the kind of process of making these things. Mm-hmm. What about selling them? Mm-hmm. How did the companies brand them? How did they label them? How did they market them to consumers?
I love, again, this is one of the things why I think sort of like a material culture approach to fashion is so important. It's the physical looking inside the garments and thinking about how you can understand how something was marketed and sold by this process. So there's a few companies who actually were putting these monogram linings into their garments. So Frederick Stark, he had monogram linings. A company called Simon Massey also did. And these monogram linings actually became quite a thing in the early 1950s as actually to get around the fact that what was happening was department stores and some independent dress shops as well were actually removing wholesale couturiers' labels from garments and trying to pass these clothes off as their own. And this was quite, it was really quite a common thing to happen. And it's about how, you know, how people used to shop in certainly in the 40s and early into the early 1950s, where arguably the shop was more important than the brand name was. But I would argue wholesale couturiers are at the forefront of this change that was taking place. What you increasingly see as the 1950s progress is this real importance of brand names. Customers were looking for the brand. They knew what brand suited them. There's a wonderful little vignette story in Anne Scott James, her book In the Mink, which is sort of a semi-autobiographical book, and she speaks about, I always know which brands suit me best. And she was writing that in the early 1950s, and still at that point, you know, that idea of people buying brands over buying from a certain shop was not unusual by any stretch, but it wasn't perhaps the norm. And I do think this speaks in some ways to that level of personal service that was so present into really stopping kind of in the 1950s, where that changes over and you perhaps get that more, you end up going more towards that focus where people know, oh, you know, these brands are the ones that are going to be most suitable for me. But wholesale couturiers, they advertised really, really heavily. So actually, when you look through the pages of a magazine like Vogue or Harper's Bazaar from particularly the 1950s, what you will notice is most of the really expensive first advertising pages as you're looking through these magazines will be the advertisements of wholesale couturiers. They spent a lot of money on their advertising. And they also, you know, this advertising, it wasn't just in the kind of your classic kind of fashion magazines. You were finding them advertising in daily newspapers. You were finding them advertising in the trade press. And some were even finding ways of kind of advertising their garments in other ways as well. In a covert way, perhaps through television broadcasts, some were producing garments for film stars. There was all sorts of ways in which they marketed their products and got their names out there. And I will just touch briefly on the television point, because actually wholesale couturiers in the early 1950s, they were dressing the announcers on BBC television, which was a really prestigious thing that they were able to get. And this was, I argue, this was really sort of quite significant that they dressed these announcers, because it points to their sort of significance in the wider trade. So when I was researching this, it's mostly Frederick Stark who's talking in the letters I found. However, it was a number of different wholesale couturiers who are part of the Model House group that were dressing these BBC announcers. So there's all sorts of really interesting ways, I think, that they were marketing their products. You know, you also have the thing as well of, and this is something I've become, actually, since writing the book, even I'd argue a bit more interested in, is this idea of fashion parades in department stores and independent dress shops, and how important that was for selling garments to the public and getting these names out there. And sometimes what you see is that the managing directors of the wholesale couture firms, they were going along to like compare these dress parades as well, which I'm sure must have been like really exciting thing to go to in the 1950s.
Hmm.
How intriguing. Thank you for kind of that overview and the specific examples. I wonder, in fact, if we can kind of expand our discussion on this point of marketing and selling, because you talk about in the book, it's not just in Britain. A lot of this wholesale couture from London also gets exported abroad. Can you tell us a bit about kind of those marketing methods? Where is this? Where are these markets? Who's buying these things outside of the UK?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really, and again, I'll go back to my physical garments and how important this has been for me in considering these ideas. So I've bought within the past sort of 15 years or so, I've bought wholesale couture pieces from around the world. One of my biggest ever regrets for something I didn't buy, actually, I will just briefly talk about because it speaks of this importance of marketing and selling. So a few years ago, I was in Stockholm in Sweden, and I went into, it's quite hard to explain, it's a bit like a British charity shop, but not quite. And I went into one, and hanging up behind the till, I couldn't believe what was there. It was the most beautiful blue satin Frederick Stark dress. And to see that there was so interesting, particularly if, now I'm not even going to try and pronounce the name, but it didn't just have the Frederick Stark label in the dress. It also had the label of the department store in Stockholm, which was in the 1950s, was one of Stockholm's leading department stores. And I thought it was just so interesting that it just happened to be there in this shop. And it was, I just really wanted to bring it home with me, but I'd gone to Stockholm with just a rucksack. So unless I'd worn it home on the plane, there was no way of bringing this beautiful dress home with me. But anyway, so I'm bringing this example up because wholesale couturiers did really well in Europe, particularly in the Nordic countries. They sold a lot there. And I've done a level of research into this selling. But whilst they didn't perhaps sell as much in the other countries I'm going to talk to, their advertising and things like that were more focused on it. So wholesale couturiers did pretty well in what were considered the Commonwealth countries. So certainly in Australia, there was a lot of wholesale couture sold to Australia. But the market that wholesale couture is really concentrated on, and this is in terms of how they were marketing their products, and also where they were going on like these specialized selling drives, was to the United States. And these selling drives, they go particularly through New York, and to a lesser extent, you do see them going through like San Francisco, Los Angeles, certainly, and a few other kind of key big American cities as well. I can certainly think of a couple happening in Chicago. And these selling drives, what they would often do is a number of manufacturers would actually go together, and they would go on these selling drives. They'd set up almost like a mini showroom in one of the hotels, and invite the American buyers to come and see their products. And they were really keen on selling to America because the value of the dollar to the pound meant that these were really important, these kind of American sales. And I think there was really a prestige to selling to America as well. And I'd argue this relates to the fact that, you know, America had this extremely advanced ready-to-wear industry, and to be able to sell back to America, it was a real sort of prestige and showing, you know, you've made it if you were able to sell back to America. I've always been particularly interested in how Frederick Stark sold to America because there's so much in the advertising where Frederick Stark himself features in this advertising. And it's sort of thinking about how the Americans really appreciated this idea of like a personality behind a brand through which these were products that they wanted to buy, which perhaps wasn't really quite the same in the UK. Whilst you would occasionally see, you know, pictures of Stark in the press, I think I found more pictures of him in the American press, which suggests how they wanted to buy their products. And, you know, there's nice little things like there's an image in my book, for example, of an advertisement which was shot in the US, and there's sort of a reciprocal thing going on here where there's an element of what's happening is that these manufacturers want to show to customers in Britain that they're selling their products in the US, because it's suggesting, you know, if we can sell these products in the US, then we're as good as the American industry is at making ready-to-wear. And I think that's interesting in positioning, and also trying to think about how manufacturers maybe are trying to persuade consumers in Britain away from buying American goods. And I say this as well I want to make the point that some wholesale couturiers had actually, particularly in the 1930s, what they were doing was they were actually buying garments in the US and then refashioning them, so altering them slightly in their London factories to sell back on the London market. So you get these, you know, this multi-layered process that happens. Even in the physical garments themselves, it becomes this multi-layered process.
Mm. No, and this is the point we've come back to, right? That this is actually all a lot more interconnected than we might think.
Yeah,
which is absolutely fascinating. We've talked obviously a bit about the 1930s, the 1940s, now a bit about the 50s and 60s. If we move to kind of the end period of the book, why do we see a decline of wholesale couture in the 1960s and 70s?
There's so many, again, interconnected factors that happen that cause this decline. I mean, one thing is one of the key things is this change in how people dress. And whilst wholesale couture is, they produce a really broad range of different clothes, I think that not that many of them are prepared to move enough with the times and realise, you know, people on a day-to-day basis don't want to wear a thick wool suit anymore. And there's an element of that that happens. And a lot of those who don't change quickly enough with the times, their companies do fold earlier. So Marcus and Brenner Sports both go fairly early in the context of other firms. So I think I should be able to remember this because I was looking at their materials the other day. I think Brenner Sports, for example, closes in about 1967. But there's a change in what consumers want to buy. There's a change in how much consumers want to pay as well. We may think of ourselves as living in an era of extremely fast fashion today, and we do, don't get me wrong. But lots of people will sort of position the beginning of this at different points. But I certainly see the 1960s as a key moment in which the industry really, really speeds up. And wholesale couturiers are not prepared, quite frankly, to produce clothing at the speed that people want to. They're slower, they run to less seasons, their clothes are more expensive. So this is a key reason why they start to fail. There's also an element here around production. And you're seeing these, you know, if people want cheaper clothes, then you need to make clothes more cheaply. But wholesale couturiers are not prepared to manufacture, really, most of them outside of London, and certainly not outside of Britain. And if you're after cheap clothes in the 60s and into the 70s, then you're really needing to manufacture overseas. And the fact that many wholesale couturiers weren't prepared, to be honest, to send their manufacturer overseas is a key reason why a lot of them eventually failed. So there's all of these interconnected factors that happen. There's also another factor, which is just the age of the managing directors behind these companies. So certainly a number of the key managing directors die in the early 1960s. And this, as their companies get passed on to their children or other people, and they're not able to run the companies in the same way. But, you know, it's understandable when to think about it, and how by the 1960s, most of the managing directors involved in these companies are in their 60s, some are even in their 70s. And even if they're employing the right people, they're just not really able to keep up with the spirit of the times in the same way. There are a few that do keep going. And you look at someone like Frederick Stark, he keeps going in one way or another through until the 1970s. And then actually, he even ends up opening another boutique of his own right at the end of his life. But I think there's the 1960s and into the early 1970s, it's a real change of British fashion. It's a real change in terms of how it's understood internationally as well. You know, you see the arrival of people like Mary Quant or Barbara Hulanicki and what they're offering. And that's so different from what wholesale couturiers are selling. But I do say this as well with Mary Quant. She established in her autobiography, she was like Harold Rose, who was behind Rose and Blem, and she suggests that Harold Rose backed her like mad. So that you know, whilst these companies may have started to fail in the 1960s, some of the key people who were behind them were still operating in one way or another in the fashion industry. And helping young designers to get their start and things like this, even if their own companies were starting to fail.
Mm. This, to me, is the section that kind of most did the what I mentioned at the beginning, the filling in the gap, the helping us understand kind of how we got from kind of, I guess, pure couture to more what we have today. So thank you for kind of taking us right up into the 70s. Obviously, the book stops there. So really, my final question to you is, now that the book has been out for a little bit, is there anything you might be currently working on or looking to work on as your next project that you could give us a sneak preview of?
Yeah, so there's a few different things I'm working on at the moment, and a couple of them are directly related to the book. And I will just kind of talk a little bit about one element of this. So one of the things when I was working on this book that I got really interested in was thinking about, you know, the international nature of London wholesale couture and how most of this was being produced by people who were of Jewish heritage. And thinking about how immigration really has transformed the British fashion industry. That's something that I'm really passionately keen to sort of always promote and talk about. And the next thing I suppose I'm working on follows on from this strand to think about a number of other immigrants who came to London and how and what they did for the London fashion industry. So I'm going a bit cheaper now. So I've gone from wholesale couture and I'm now looking more actually at what we might consider the popular price trade. And my current research is really focused on a manufacturer called Louis Mintz. And he established a brand called Linda Lee. And I'm really interested in this because it's one of the leading what we would now term plus size, but was then termed outsize manufacturers. So yeah, my current research is really focused on what Louis Mintz did for the outsize industry. Whilst actually plus size, outsize, stout size, however you want to describe it, clothes have been increasingly studied in the US. It's something that's been really, really missing, I think, from considerations of British fashion. So, yeah, I'm only in the early stages of this research, but that's what I'm primarily focusing on at the moment.
Well, once you've gone further through the research, maybe it'll become a book and we can have you back and you can tell us about it. But of course, best of luck with that in the meantime. And while you're working on it, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Wholesale Couture, London and Beyond, 1930 to 70, published by Bloomsbury. Liz, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time speaking to you today.